Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This episode, this was a nice one. The gentleman got in touch with me, Mr. Michael J. Miller. He plays in a whole bunch of bands from Rapporteers and Adrenaline. And I thought, like, this wonderful career and just even now bringing out even more new music. And it was just a wonderful conversation we had that led to getting him on the show. And the conversation that you'll hear now is a bigger version of that conversation. He's going to be inducted into the Academia Music Hall of Fame. And it was nice to reflect back on where he started, his journey through and his career, and where it's led up to now. And, you know, the guy's been doing it a long time and been in the business, functioning as an artist for a long time. And I thought that you would get an awful lot from this conversation. If you were starting out in your journey, if you were, you know, a long way into your career or what have you, just show you the kind of a functioning professional musician that's been doing this for a long time. It's wonderful. Michael's a wonderful person. I'm really, you know, really funny and really honest about kind of where he come from and, you know, the challenges he faced and that. And we only talked for a briefest amount of time. Because he's a very busy gentleman, and so I'm definitely going to get him on the show again. I think it'd be just wonderful to speak to him. If you are listening to the show and you enjoy it, you know, I'm loving the messages that I'm getting back. I'm getting it's wonderful to be mentioned in people's Spotify Wrapped lists of people saying that this is their top podcast, which is just, I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful. And the messages you get and suggesting people to be on the show, I build up a list that I may never get to the end of, which was something I was worried about when I first started. So I'd be like, would I get enough people to be able to come on the show? That is never going to be the case. I have a list as long as you want. I've just finished one looking forward to, which I'll spill a little bit of tea, is with Mad Spanner, which is going to be a great episode. I can't wait for you to hear that. Get that out before Christmas if I can. And so this one here, though, This is a wonderful episode. I really enjoyed this. This is something, you know, grab yourself a cup of tea, or if you're in the car, you know, back and relax. If you're listening on a tour bus somewhere, find yourself a quiet space and kind of give this a listen. This really inspired me, and it really kind of made me think about, you know, sometimes when you start off a journey, you know, you don't know where it's going to end, but that shouldn't stop you from starting that journey. It shouldn't stop you from following the dreams you have about the thing that you want to become. This is a wonderful conversation with Michael J. Miller, MJM. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure and a real honour to have this next guest on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Michael J. Miller to the show. How are we doing, sir?
Hi, Mark. I'm doing great, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. We were just talking. I'll spill a little tea. We were just talking. We were going to do this interview and go maybe an hour or whatever long it takes. But Michael had the best reason in the world for not doing a long interview, because he's going to a show tonight. He has tickets to see Beast in Black. And I think that's really cool. That's the best reason to do this. This is the whole reason for the show, my friend.
Yeah, it's all about rock and roll. And it's been a rock and roll Sunday for me all day.
Yeah.
Doing stuff with, I have a new release coming up, a new single. And so I'm coordinating getting it loaded up to Spotify and the release date set, and then all the promo that goes along with it. So yeah, it's been a pretty busy day.
Yeah, but that's a nice busy though, isn't it? That's a nice busy. You're building a house, essentially. It's nice. You get a house at the end of it, and you, in your case, you launch a great single.
How true it is. Yes, it is. Yeah. And it's something I can live with, like a house. That's right.
I suppose we can't go any further without mentioning that you are now inducted into the Hall of Fame, Academia Hall of Fame. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Wow.
Heading down to Hollywood next May to receive the award in person at the gala. So it's pretty cool.
That's ace. That's an incredible thing. If you said to your 10-year-old self that you were going to be inducted into a musical hall of fame, what do you think they would have said?
I was still trying to figure out how to play the guitar back then. So, yeah, I don't know what I would have thought. I would have thought, geez, I always wanted to be like a Beatle.
Okay. Yeah.
Something like that.
So let's go back to that then. So when did you first hear music of any kind? When did that come into your life?
I had a very interesting upbringing musically, because all my family was involved with music. My father played in the Air Force band, a saxophone and clarinet. That was during World War II. And my mother played the piano. My sister also played the piano. My other brother played the guitar. And my oldest brother was an avid record collector. He would always have the newest singles. Every week he'd buy 45s, were a popular thing back then. And he would always have the newest 45 of the week every week. So I got to hear all the newest stuff from when I was just a toddler. So I grew up getting the chance to hear the evolution of music and all the different styles before it ever even got heavy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool.
So it was like, was it a lot of blues records, or was it like, was the British Invasion happening around then? Or
Yes, it was the right. British Invasion big time. And then the American, counterparts or whatever, you know, they're the Beach Boys, Paul Revere and the Raiders. And geez, from the British Invasion, like Dave Clark Five, they're a great band, right?
Yeah. But isn't it interesting that initially it was in the UK during the time when it, like the likes of the Beatles and stuff and Paul Revere and the Raiders and all that type of music was going on. They wanted to be like their American counterparts. And then when we came over, like the Dave Clark Five and stuff, they wanted to be like the UK bands. And it was a wonderful back and forth. He was like, we had the Stones, okay, then you bring out Aerosmith. And then it was like back and forth, you know?
That is so true. We over here in Canada always think that we're 2 years, or this is how I was brought up, thinking that we're a year or two behind what's happening in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, if you find out some new cool stuff that's already going on there, we're just hearing about it. Example, David Bowie or Mott the Hoople or whatever, they're already really doing well in the UK before we ever caught any word of them, right?
Yeah. There's a slight delay for the Canadian delay, we shall call it. So you obviously have this incredible sort of rich upbringing musically, where you're having a lot of things kind of thrown at you, great stuff kind of thrown at you. When was it that you started to gravitate to a particular band or a particular artist or a musician? Was the one who stood out that you were like, they're my guy or they're my girl?
Yeah, I would have to say... as a child, seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show come over and create Beatlemania, that was definitely a memorable occasion for the whole world. And it stuck in my memory as something that no other band will ever do quite the same way, because that type of situation would never
happen again. It was so unique. There were so many firsts. Apparently, the story goes, McCartney tells the story that the curtains part, but just before the curtains part, they aren't done by a mechanism. It's two guys that pull the curtain apart. And so there's McCartney and the band there ready to go in front of, you know, however many millions of people, hundreds of millions of people watching. Yeah. And this kind of like caretaker guy pulling the curtains back goes, oh, you know, don't shit yourself. And then the curtains open, there's millions of people, and then off they go. It's interesting how many bands and how many musicians strike that as being a real, that's one of those points in music, isn't it? Like a lightning bolt in music, one of those real moments where it changes everything. Like the first time you see Elvis comes out and does Elvis as we know him, you know, it's one of those real lightning bolt moments where a lot of bands suddenly went, okay, let's become a band, you know, the original sort of garage band, if you will.
Yeah, that is so true. It probably made a lot of people want to buy a guitar and try to figure it out.
Yeah. So did you start then learning Beatles songs? Were you just like, were you driven to the guitar first and foremost?
Well, I wasn't old enough to play a guitar back when I first heard them. I was pretty young, but my brother did have a nice Fender Stratocaster, and I would pluck away at the strings, but I couldn't really, I didn't know how to hold my fingers or press the strings to make a note or anything. Yeah. Not until later when I hit 9 years old, my mother put me in for guitar lessons, fortunately with a good teacher. And that started my whole learning thing. I took lessons for about 3 years till I was about 12. And then I started getting, music started changing. I started hearing Jimi Hendrix and other heavy stuff. And one of the main guitar players that actually really inspired me to figure out the guitar on my own was Johnny Winter. You know, Edgar and Johnny Winter?
Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic. Absolutely. Yeah, I had the Johnny Winter Live and album, and I listened to that till I pretty well wore it out. And I tried learning everything his fingers were doing at a young age, just listening to putting the needle back and listening to that section over and over.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out, where is he going? How is he doing that, right? And that's actually how I got better on the guitar after lessons, was just studying other guitar players.
I mean, like the stuff, you know, 10 years after and stuff like that, that's still held on as being great guitar playing. Even now, that's still really important guitar playing. And it's interesting you bring up that's how you learned, by literally maneuvering a needle to the point of the record repeatedly. It wouldn't do it for you. You had to do it. And then ear training yourself and listening to the record. And even in the days now where we have everything available, where we can watch videos and break down every single note, that whole point of ear training and the patience and listening and really concentrating on what you were listening to is one of the reasons, like yourself, will develop a really strong ear, a real patience, and you're really listening to the music, you know, really locked in and to listening to stuff. So he was kind of the first guy. That's a great first guy to be influenced by, because he's a mountain. It's huge. You know, it's like you're never gonna sound exactly like him. So yeah, that must have been quite a thing. Were you playing with other people soon after, or when did it come to more of a band situation?
I had my first first band when I was in grade 5. It's kind of funny. The senior kids, the grade 7 and 8s, were putting together a talent show. And these kids, I knew that one of them was a drummer who could actually play. He put together a band with some other guys that couldn't really play. And he asked me, even though I was only in grade 5, he knew I could play. He said, "Would you like to come and see if you can play these songs with me?" And so I came for one rehearsal, and they said, "You're in," right? So so in grade 5, and I gave the band their name, the Surfers.
That's surf a pretty music. Cool first band name. I'm obsessed with first band names. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool. And then not a lot happened with that group after that. But that band actually, the drummer, he reformed with a couple other guys in my town. And later on, there was an unfortunate accident where one of the boys was killed in a sports game, you know, hockey game. He took a puck to the chest and killed him. Yeah. So I heard about the bad news, and I went up to Jeff, was the drummer's name. And I said, "Listen, I'm really sorry about hearing what happened. It's terrible. But if your guys are considering getting another guitar player, I'd like to let you know I'm interested in doing it." And he said, "Well, I'll talk to them." So a few days later, he let me know that they were game for doing it, and they had me in. And then I joined that band, and we called ourselves Touch. And Touch. Yeah, there's Kiss, and then there's Touch, right?
I get it.
What do you want to do? Both.
That's so obvious now you said it. I'm like, why didn't I think of that as my band name? It's so obvious. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised nobody's used it to this day. I should still be using it. That band, I was already writing my own music when I joined the group. So I came to the to that band with some original songs, and the band started learning them, and we started getting offered dates. And by the time I was in high school, we were playing high school audiences of 800, 1,000 people.
Wow.
In grade 9, grade 10. Yeah, it was pretty cool. I got to be a rock star in high school in my hometown, right?
Do you remember the moment where you kind of felt like a rock star? Do you remember what it was? Was it coming out? Was it a round of applause? What was it? Was the moment when you were like, actually, This is pretty cool.
Well, back then, I think I was still pretty new to the whole performing thing, and I was glad to be doing it, and I was still looking to bigger things. I was noticing there were bands like Kiss and whatever, Alice Cooper, and and that's really what I wanted to do. So as that band Touch, we started to go through our high school years. When the other guys got to their final year, and then they were done high school, and I said, well, what are you guys going to do now? And they said, well, we're moving off to this city and that city to go to university. And I still had another year of high school left. But what I did was after school, as a friend convinced me to come to Toronto and try to find serious band members. And so he said he could, I could stay with him for a week down in the city where I am now. And we went to different music stores, checking billboards for musicians that were available that had similar interests. And I met a lot of musicians in that week, and some of them I still know to this day. And one fella I met that week happened to be the drummer from Rapid Tears that I wound up forming the band with. So yeah. It was a good, a fruitful week. It actually worked out. And at the end of the week, I went back to my family back in my hometown, and I said, I'm going to move to Toronto.
I'm leaving and joining the circus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as to answer your question, when did I feel like a real rock star? Well, not till I was on the radio and on TV and watching myself live in concert on TV.
Yeah.
Then I went, yeah, it looks like it's happening.
Is saying to, because you're a musical family, so is saying, I'm going to go off and join a rock and roll band. Is that like, that must be a massive win for that family. They must have, like, you must have graduated from family university, so to speak, by saying that to them. They must have been like, that's our boy. He's learned everything that we've taught him, and now he's going to go off to rock the world, you know?
Well, I think they were kind of shocked. You know, my father tried talking me out of it, actually, because he said, you know, Michael, I've been a musician for a good part of my life, and it's a really hard road, and I can get you a job where I work. We have the biggest salt mine in the world is Sifto Salt, which is right. In my hometown. And my father was one of the bigger figures there, and he said he could get me a job right then at 18 years old for big dollars per hour. And he said, you know, you'll have a pension plan and you'll be able to retire when you're 60 and all this stuff. And I said, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do that at all.
Yeah.
And he looked at me like I was making a big mistake, right?
Yeah.
But he couldn't change my mind. He said, well, don't say I didn't warn you. You're in for a hard road. And he was right about that. It's definitely a hard road. But when you become the musician that I am, it's, and that I've always been, it's been impossible to turn it off, to stop it and say, I don't do this. Yeah. I'm not what I am. I just keep keep writing songs and producing music and always dying to be on the stage.
Yeah. It's something, you know, that performers who are naturally drawn to performance, they just can't settle for a normal, in inverted commas, a normal life. It's, you know, it's just something that it's inside them that just, it has to get out one way or the other. And you know, we're now talking, ladies and gentlemen, and on the back you'll see a whole bunch of great guitars and amplifiers, and Michael is an extremely happy gentleman. He made the right choice, ladies and gentlemen. I may have to tell you, he made the right choice. But I mean, I was listening back to Rapid Tears and the whole discography, and I'd not heard of them. I'm not embarrassed to say I'd had not heard of them. And I went back and I thought, you guys must have been massive then. Were you one of those bands that were from Canada that never really kind of got out, or did you get out into the US a little bit more? What was the situation with them?
Well, we did have record sales, minimal record sales around the world. We have wound up in the Metal Encyclopedia. which is good. And we have a Wikipedia page. But we never got to travel Europe. There were some record company problems where they couldn't really support us the way a band needs. Canada's a little stiff that way, especially when you're doing the type of music we were doing. There was some reluctance from the industry, but nonetheless, we had to keep doing it. We did have, it's kind of funny, our first break into the United States was foiled because we had a date scheduled with Venom. We were Rapid Tears and Venom. We're going to be playing on just the other side of the U.S. border in Buffalo. And something happened with Venom where they got refused admittance to the country at that time. Or I shouldn't specify what the reason was. But nonetheless, the concert, we didn't even know, was canceled until we didn't know until we got to the U.S. border and they hauled us aside. They knew who we were. And they said, listen, we're not letting you guys across because there's a riot going on at the concert hall. She says there's 20,000 people there that are going insane and there's riot squads in and the police are trying to disperse the crowd. So we're not letting you guys across the border. You're not going there for your own safety. And they held us at the border for about 3 hours. And they kept checking. And then 3 or 4 hours later, they came to us and said, well, the police have cleared everything up. You can cross the border now if you want. So now it's getting dark out. We still have our equipment still in the truck and everything. And we go to the concert hall. And, of course, the whole area has been really destroyed. The kids were doing everything, you know, turning garbage cans upside down and just knee-high in litter. And we went to the concert hall and tried banging on the doors to get in to see if the promoter was still there. And it took about 10 minutes. And then a guy opened the door and he was scared, right? He said, oh, it's you guys, man, I'm really sorry. Come on in, have a look at where the show would have been. It was a great concert hall.
No, that's crushing though to get shown around it and know you're not playing it. Oh my God. You must have been like so close.
It was going to open the door for us in the United States, and that was it. We after seeing the concert hall, we turned around and came home. I think we bought some American beer and then headed back to Canada.
So, I mean, it's, ladies and gentlemen, we will get Michael on again because there's so much to cover. Talk about a life in music. It's unbelievable. I just want to quickly talk about Adrenaline then. So Rapid Tears ends kind of amicably and you kind of decide, okay, we're going to go our separate ways. And is there something in between that and then Adrenaline, or did Adrenaline come after that directly?
This is a very good question, and it's a bit of a sensitive issue. the band had Rapid Tears had broken up because of too many different directions that different people wanted to go in. Okay, The drummer was finding his way into dark metal, and the singer wanted to be more commercial. And I was happy just writing what I was writing. And so I did keep working with the other guitar player, Clayton, and I continued working with the singer. And then one day he told me that he was moving to Sweden. And I looked at him and I thought, well, what about what we're doing? He goes, I know, I just need a change. I'm going to Sweden. So he just up and left for Sweden. And that really put the end to Rapid Tears. And so I kept writing with the other guitar player. And that's when I got new members and we formed the group Adrenaline, which we recorded. I did get a recording deal in Toronto to fund the recording of the album. And after that, I signed the album to a deal with a German record label called Long Island Records. And they were pretty good for us. They managed to get sales all across Europe, the UK and Japan, the United Emirates and whatever. But they didn't get us a U.S. deal, which was kind of weird, right? So that really made it difficult, again, in our own home continent, when meanwhile we were doing interviews on the radio and whatever for in Belgium or Holland or whatever, but Canada and U.S. didn't know about us. So, and then we wound up with some personal difficulties in Adrenaline too, with the lead singer, and we had to change him. We got another guy, and then after that, it just wasn't going good with lead singers. And that's when I decided that I can't have my music and career being held up by decisions that lead singers make.
Right.
And I decided that I would just start being my own artist, MJM, Michael J. Miller Band, right?
Yeah.
So that's when I took on the vocals.
You know, you essentially, Michael, bet on yourself. You know that you were talented, you could write this music, and you knew what you wanted to say, and you wanted to produce. And you've been in several bands at this point and kind of gone, okay, I understand how the game's played, I understand what goes on. I'm now going to bet on myself and you know, produce my own music and do it this way. And that's incredibly empowering. There'll be a lot of people who are listening to this who'll go, I want to do my own stuff, and maybe I'm unhappy in the situation I've got, and you know, we'll take something from this, and certainly from your story, I want to change and go, okay, listen, I'm going to get my own project together and get it done. That's the most powerful side of it. But there's another side of it where it is your name now on the label, so to speak. It's your name out there. That's true. Frightening as well, right? Because you it's your responsibility. You are the sole owner of yourself, you know. So
you said it. Yes,
that's
it
scary
has
too, right?
With it being under my solo name, I am responsible. I'm the sole proprietor of this organization. I've really got to keep a lot in order. There's a lot of things to do, right?
If you go by your own name, it's like the Van Halen brothers. You can't get away. You are Van Halen and you are the Van Halen brothers. It's like you have to, whatever you produce is there's no getting away from it. It's you to the nth degree, isn't it? And I think that's a great thing, you know.
Yeah, I'm glad I did it, because it's the first time where I haven't had, a lead singer ruining or stalling my career because of things they do that go totally against what the rest of the band is thinking.
Yeah.
Now the people that I work with, we get along quite well, and there's a good level of respect, and we've been together for 20 years.
It's like when I went and listened to the MJM stuff, and I suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that you go and listen to it as well. It sounds freer, if that's a way of expressing it, but it's still really heavy as well, Michael. There's some really heavy sections in that, really heavy. And I was really sort of like Loves a Crime and stuff. You know, these are that middle sections, that's super heavy, and it sounds like, as another guitar player to another guitar player, right, it sounds like you're actually enjoying yourself while you play. You know, you can tell that with a guitar player. You're like, you know, Eddie Van Halen, when he was writing and playing Panama, that he was smiling while he was writing that riff. You know he was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I know you're smiling playing this stuff as well, which is a fantastic thing to hear on a record, because you can't really get that. You can't force that. It exists or it doesn't. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, when you listen to the record, you'll agree with me that it does sound like we're getting unfettered, Michael here. We're getting him free and doing what he wants to do. I suppose the interesting question I have to pose is, then, you've been around for a long time. You've seen a lot of different series of things, of changes, social media coming into even how we produce records and everything in between. And now, coming to this sort of stage in your career and knowing all those things, where do you start really approaching social media? Because it must be an interesting thing for you, because you can remember, like you say, buying a single and now we're streaming. Is that still tough to get your head around? Is that still difficult?
Oh, it's,
seen so it's, much?
That's quite a question, and it is quite an answer for that. It's vast. It's huge, the amount of resources that are available through social media. But again, trying to encompass even part of it and manage it. There's so much out there to manage and control. It's hard for me to do. That's where I'm hiring different virtual assistants and whatever to take care of different things, right? But this whole social media thing has really changed. It kind of has taken us back to, believe it or not, where 45s were a big thing a long time ago. Now, with streaming music, a lot of younger kids don't even know what an album is. They just hear a song from this band, from that band, and they don't even think of the term album. As for when you or I were getting into music, we first thing we identified was the album that band made that the song is from, and we would look at the artwork and the band members' names and what they play, and we'd really take that album as a real specific contribution to that era of their whole career.
It's interesting that we talk about, you know, going back to the early sort of Beatles records that would come over, and you would listen to the singles only. And, you know, you think about, like, we talk about guitar players, you think about Hendrix as, like, was first singles before we got albums, you know. And it seems like music is cyclical. We know that. It goes in circles. But it seems to be that the method of listening to it seems to be cyclic as well now, because we're going to the point where now artists, like you say, the modern listener doesn't really listen to albums anymore. We've gone back to the single.
It has.
Which is interesting. You know, I think that's quite exciting, because now you've got to do what I mentioned, Hendrix, but what you've got to do with, like, where Jimi Hendrix, where you've got to have a song, great song, but you're allowed to experiment within that song. And often, as guitar players, that's where the experimentation happens, normally in a solo or something. Yeah. That's where it would happen. Someone like Jeff Beck would do something interesting in a Yardbird solo, and that would it be contained within a song. And listening to the stuff that you play, and certainly the stuff that I've listened to at MGM, that seems to be, you know, where you enjoy yourself the most, in those moments where you can kind of do a little bit, sort of go a little bit crazy and do your own thing, you know. We live in a world where now guitarists can sound the same too often. They can sound the same because they learn the same way. Especially when I hear you bending and stuff like that, I hear that ear training. I hear that young lad putting that needle onto the record. I hear that in the playing. Ladies and gentlemen, I really urge you to check out Michael's stuff. So you've got a new single. Is that coming up soon then?
Yes, it's going to be released on Spotify first on October 2nd. Mm-hmm. And it's a great song. It's been well produced and recorded and produced. It's geared towards radio. As far as, like, I didn't write anything dark and gloomy with this song. It's a very positive, happy type of metal rock song, right?
Yeah.
It's something that'll light people up. The song's called Live It Up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. I say heavy, but in the same way, when I listen to it, I found it incredibly empowering and incredibly, you know, upbeat, even though it's heavy, still massively upbeat. I was listening with a smile on my face. So I really was. So I'm looking forward to hearing the single. I think that's what we love it. So touring, what are you going to do? Are you going to come out of Canada and try the US? Can we tempt you over to Europe to play some festivals? You know,
can we tempt you
over?
Yeah, we would love to come over. We just need the proper agreement to get us there, right?
Yeah.
We would love to come and play Europe and travel and to the UK. And sure, we'd love to.
I think, ladies and gentlemen, it's been wonderful sitting here with Michael. Michael represents one of the things as another guitar player I love the most. He's that guitar player that's joining bands and writing songs and just putting the work in and doing it. And sir, I salute you for doing that, and for, you know, we're doing this so long, and is an inspiration to people starting their career, in the middle of their career, maybe thinking their career's over, at the end of their career. You are a vast inspiration to that. Like, certainly what you've done, you know, you took a chance all that many time ago. And aren't we all grateful, ladies and gentlemen, that he chose this life over the salt mine life? we're very grateful, sir. Have you wrote your acceptance speech for the Hall of Fame yet? Have you wrote it?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
It has been written.
Can we get a snippet? Who are you going to thank?
I thank academia for one, and I thank my producer for his long-standing commitment and faith in me as an artist and a writer. He's really an essential part of the production of my music. He's a great producer, and my bandmates, of course, for putting their faith in me and going under my own name.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty cool.
It's very cool. It's it's a life well led. You know, many albums, many tours, great bands, great player. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been wonderful to sit down with Michael J. Miller. We're going to get him on again because this is far. We cut an entire life of music down into 40 or so minutes. It's ridiculous. So we will get him on again. Maybe when he announces that tour around Europe that we need to see him on. Sir, it was wonderful to talk to you. Some great stories there. And I'll see you again. And enjoy the show tonight.
I'm looking forward to that. And I'll certainly be looking forward to another interview with you, Mark, on the Spoken Metal Show.
Thank you very much, sir. It was a great time.
I had a blast. It was wonderful meeting you. And I have many more stories. Just keep those questions coming, and we'll see what new golden nuggets we discover.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael J. Miller, thanks for coming on the show, sir. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Michael there talking about his, you know, what a wonderful career and life in music he chose early on. The guitar called him and rock and metal music called him when he went and followed that dream, you know, and lives his life as a professional musician even now. You know, it's as he releases new work and new singles and new albums and stuff. He's got some new music coming out, which I'll share naturally in the show notes. But what a wonderful story about someone, you know, becoming a professional musician and earning a living from it. And it's something they did in their dream and continues to do so, you know, and then gets inducted into a Hall of Fame, gets recognized for the work he does and the music he makes. And what a just a super, super nice gentleman. We'll definitely obviously get him on the show again. But it really kind of made me think about, you know, how long bands are before they consider themselves successful. You know, if they're not successful in the first, you know, 12 weeks of them being out, and then the first 12 months to a year of existing, if they're not, you know, headlining a festival, it's like, it's not really about that. The only measurement should be your own enjoyment. Are you enjoying the music that you're doing? And, you know, and that's absolutely key. You know, clearly, you know, Michael totally adores the music that he does, and whether it becomes, whatever, in inverted commas, massively successful or not, he still isn't enjoying that. That's not to say you shouldn't work at it and you should put the time in, but it's got to be something that comes from a heart, right? It's got to be something that you believe in. All too often we've seen those bands that are just seem like they're going through the motions now and they don't really seem as though they believe in it. And so voices like Michael's come through for me because it shows that he does, and he still loves what he does and believes in the music that he's making. Incredibly powerful stuff. Once again, you know, I'm getting messages for now for guests for the show, and I just want to put it out there. I'm open to having any guests at all, as long as there's some kind of metal connection, and I'm all ears. And you know, bands have been sending me stuff and asking me if I will feature songs on the Spoken Metal Show. And what I think I'll do is I'll possibly start putting them at the very end, maybe as a play out song. Maybe we should do that. What do you think? Tell me what you think. Because I don't really do reviews per se. I don't really review things. I only talk about things that I love. And if I review stuff, there might be something that I didn't like. And I don't want to say that because I only want to be positive. And I only want to talk, you know, positively about things. I did a long, many years of reviewing music, and it started to become a little bit jaded to it. And you kind of, you know, the reviews where you slay people sometimes get more attention, and that really just breeds negativity, which is not what this show is about, not what I'm about. But if you You know, if you are in a band, instead of doing a review, hey, come on the show. Let's talk about your latest single. Let's talk about your latest album. Let's talk about your band. Let's talk about whatever you want to talk about. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. Also, what's going to be a lot of fun on the 10th of February next year is the Spoken Metal Show Sessions, where I'm going to take a group of bands possibly you've not heard of. These are not massive bands. In some cases, they're playing the first couple of shows, but I think are going to be absolutely superb. And are just starting out on their journey. Slightly more established bands as well, and kind of going to mix it up. But bands you probably haven't caught before, I'm going to showcase them. We're going to interview them as well. It's going to be a little bit like Jules Holland Metal, if you will. It's going to be a real, real, real good show, this one. Thrasher 2, you're playing their first show in Liverpool, the crazy chef metal thrash metalers. Who doesn't want to see that in the outpost where they serve pizza as well? This is just, you know, meant to be, isn't it? And then you got 7 Years Dead, which is just one of those bands that just absolutely blew my mind at the Metal to the Masses. So I really want to see them open up for a good set and a full set from them. And then, you know, Mortalla. I mean, I've talked about Mortalla before. I think they're very special. I think they're very interesting. And I think that they're really going to blow people's minds. And that's what I want this to be. There's lots of shows where there's loads of acts that have been around a long time, established bands, bands that have broken through. I want to give an opportunity to bands that maybe haven't even been heard before. That's really exciting to me. And I just think that they're very interesting. Once again, doing something that I love. And it's going to be at a place that I love, in the Outpost in Liverpool. That's the 10th of February. So if you check in the show notes and on the socials, you'll see a way of buying tickets for that. I think the cap is 70, so we'll probably have to get a wriggle on if you want to get tickets for that. And that's going to be I'm going to do that many times a year, hopefully, as well as doing the Spoken live show many, many times a year as well. Once again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the show.